Good morning, everyone, to another exciting day, which we start off with insurance contracts and amendments to the standard, and I hand over to Laura, I suppose.
Thank you, Andreas. Okay, so we have four papers for you today on the proposed narrow scope amendment to IFRS 17. Agenda paper two is just a background paper summarizing the amendment proposed in the exposure draft. Papers 2A and 2B are the technical redeliberation papers for today, and then 2C asks for your permission to begin the balloting process. We received 46 comment letters on the exposure draft. All of the respondents were supportive of the proposed amendment, and most of them suggested some changes or clarifications. And those are what we're covering in 2A and 2B. The analysis in those papers focuses only on the incremental costs and benefits relating to respondents' suggested changes to the proposal rather than the proposal from the ED. So let's start with 2A on scope. We had two separate requests to expand the scope of the classification overlay, so I'll introduce each of those two sections separately. The first section is from paragraph 5 down to question 1, and it's on a suggestion to remove a restriction that's proposed in the ED. And the proposed restriction would prevent entities from applying the overlay to financial assets that are unconnected to insurance activities. Almost all of the respondents suggested that the board remove that restriction, because they said that doing so would align the scope of this proposal with the temporary exemption from IFRS 9 that they applied. It would allow entities to present more financial assets in the comparatives consistently with IFRS 9, and it would help to reduce their operational complexity for preparers. On balance, the staff agree with respondents, and in the paper, we're recommending that the board remove the restriction. So I'll now hand over to the board to discuss the first section of the paper and question one.
Thank you, Laura. Can I see whether board members have any comments, questions? Mary.
I think there's a good explanation of why, especially operationally, this would make application of the overlay simpler for those preparing financial statements. There didn't seem to be an explicit discussion of the impact on users of financial statements, although there is the general statement that the overlay only improves the usefulness of the comparative period. And I didn't know whether to take that assessment, that statement about improves the overlay as the shorthand for the analysis of the impact on users.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, Mary. So, because I think we were focusing so much on the suggestions that were made, we didn't think so much about the benefit for users, which we focused on in the ED. But I think, from our perspective, because using the overlay will make it lets those preparers treat more financial assets in a more consistent manner. So there'll be more comparability within the entity's financial assets presented.
And I don't remember anything that we were trying to do with the restrictions in terms of preventing abuse, et cetera. My recollection is we were just trying to describe the plot of items that were creating problems, but I just wanted to check
Yeah,
that.
exactly that. We didn't put a restriction in because we were worried about abuse. We just put it there because we're doing a narrow scope amendment so close to the effective date of IFRS 17. So we were just really trying to focus in on the issue that we were told about, and that was an accounting mismatch between assets and related assets and liabilities. So, yeah.
I think it's worthwhile to remind us that we are talking about comparative information,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So we are not talking about the actual period. Sure.
Thanks. I support the staff recommendation, but I did sort of mull over it for a while because I felt as though, we really started out thinking about mismatches, and I can see why people say, well, this seems odd because it's different to the scoping for the deferral option. But it does mean you could have situations where you don't have this mismatch situation, and it would seem to me that in a perfect world, we'd probably say, well, this is fine, but you have to do it for everything, so you can't choose which assets to apply it to. but who am I to stop people applying more IFRS 9 than... must always be good, right? So I think on balance, and particularly to Andreas's point, because this is, you know, comparatives matter, but it is only for a short period of time, and as long as we've got good transparency, which we'll get onto later, on balance, I agree with this. And we don't want to make it too complicated, if we can help it.
Yes, I also support staff's recommendation. I think, as Andrew said, that this narrow scope amendment is issue-oriented amendment. So previously, what we heard is there are significant, you know, mismatch arising from those financial assets connected to the insurance contract. Then we address that. But when I look at the feedback we received from stakeholders after we issued the exposure draft, there are additional concern raised because those companies, they have to make distinguish between those financial assets connected to insurance contract, those financial assets not connected to insurance contract, and develop different accounting treatment during the comparative period. I think it's previously the objective was try to ease those insurance companies to apply IFRS 9 and IFRS 16. But with that restriction, actually, it caused a little bit, you know, complexity for those insurance companies. So I do have sympathy with those additional concerns raised by the insurance companies. So another thing about the users' needs, you know, from my perspective, I think actually it will improve the comparability of those information provided to the users to help users to look at one single, you know, insurance company, those financial assets actually apply same, you know, accounting treatment during that comparative, you know, period. So I think it will provide useful information to the users. So with that, I agree with staff's recommendation. I think it will be welcomed by those stakeholders. Thank you.
I agree with the staff recommendation. And I thank them for the very clear analysis. Even me, I was able to understand which is on those subjects shows an achievement on your side. So I don't know if do we enter into a bit more detailed comments or we stay general?
We can, as long as they are tied to question one.
Okay, so I stop there at the moment.
Excellent. Lika?
Thank you. I support the staff recommendation given the restricted scope of the insurers applicable to this narrow scope amendment and also consideration of the nature of insurance businesses. Because I think for insurers and users of insurance financial statement, it's really crucial to analyze financial information for a longer period rather than the shorter period. And especially compared with other entities in other non-insurance industry. So I think a removal of the restriction can allow the entity to provide more comparable information to the user to analyze the future. And then they can use the future, assess the future performance going forward. So I think that's... that recommendation is consistent with the objective of this narrow scope amendment.
Eureka? Nick?
Yeah, so I also support staff recommendation here. I think this reduces the complexity of applying the overlay, so it lowers the cost, means more entities are likely to apply it, better comparative information for users. So.
Very sharp, you know. I like that, yeah. Thank you, Nick. Tadeo?
Thank you, Andreas, and thanks to staff for the papers. I think that whatever the, as I understood from discussing with the staff, that was very helpful. I think whatever the preparer does, it will impact virtually the comparative figures only and would make it more, even more comparative. And then therefore I understand why the staff is saying the argument that it can only increase the quality, although it is optional, but that makes sense in a transition, as a transition rule. And I just want to comment that I agree with Mary that the comments on the user's feedback. I think that although it seems too obvious that it just increases the comparability, I think it's important just to assure with the users that they agree with that. I don't know whether we could do that through the CMAC or just a one-to-one, but I think that's important, having this feedback from them. Thank you.
Thanks, Tadeo. Zach?
So I'll be short as well. I'm supportive of the staff's recommendation. I do truly think it's about rebuilding better comparability using the comparative period. The other thing that gives me comfort is paragraph 13, which reminds us that the only group that was allowed to follow this pattern of transition was those who were predominantly engaged in insurance activities. So it really is about the simplicity of not having to identify upfront the assets that are going to be derecognized during the year, which is a challenge for any of us, I think. So I'm supportive of the recommendation.
Excellent. And if I can circle back that then to Tadeo, I think that gives me some comfort that our two investor representatives are actually happy with that. So I would be surprised if actually there was a broad user base that would say, don't go there. With that, can I see a show of hands who agrees with the staff recommendation on question one?
12.
Thank you. Well done. Laura, next question.
Okay. So the second section starts from paragraph 18 down to question two. And it's on a suggestion that came from fewer respondents, and this one was to expand the scope so that the overlay apply for entities that already applied IFRS 9. So those entities, when they first apply IFRS 17, they have a specific transition requirement there. That's paragraph C29. And that requires or permits redesignation of financial assets in certain circumstances. So, for example, it provides those entities with a fair value option that could be used to resolve accounting mismatches between assets and insurance liabilities relating to the initial application of IFRS 17. And those respondents essentially said that those entities face a similar accounting mismatch in the comparatives to the one that we're proposing to resolve for others, because that paragraph C29 that they get applies at the date of initial application of 17. And so similarly, it can't be applied to financial assets that are derecognized in the comparative period. The staff think that the classification overlay could be expanded for those entities, but for those entities, it would have a direct connection to the paragraph that they apply. So that's paragraph C29. And we've described that in paragraph 27 of the paper. And on balance, we're recommending that the board make that amendment. So I will now hand over to you to discuss the second section and question two.
Thank you, Laura.
I agree with the recommendation. The only thing that just strikes me thinking about this is that probably the area where the board historically at least has been strictest with changes in measurement is the use of the fair value option. So I think even in times where the board's allowed reclassifications, we've been pretty strict about the fair value option designations being a sort of a one-off thing because of the risk of cherry picking. And I guess if we say here that an entity expects to be using the designation under C29, there's sort of two aspects of that. One is, do you expect there to be a mismatch? And secondly, do I expect to make the choice?
Yeah.
I think our expectation is that if they choose this, they expect there both to be a mismatch and they expect there to be a choice. I'm not sure if it's worth the complexity of saying, by the way, you can't change your mind if there's a mismatch. But I think we should think about that in the drafting, but I'm comfortable with the basic premise that, you know, if they are sort of intending almost to use the designation on the date of initial application, then bringing that forward I think is fine for me. But, you know, it does raise the question, can they just decide I don't feel like doing the designation anymore?
I would think so. I understand.
You know what I'm saying?
I do. But I think it is sort of, it's linked to the discussion we had in June or July around this, in the sense that when they prepare their comparatives, especially those that have already applied 9 and they know they're going to exercise the designation for their assets, they would probably want to roll that back so that the whole of next year they run on that sort of parallel basis. And so, yes, I agree with you. They've got the strong expectation that they're going to exercise the designation under the fair value option. They just don't know which assets they're going to sell so that they can bring them back to Amatos Corp.
So we're intending that if they choose this now and they've still got the asset, they continue to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we should say that's what we mean. But on the basis.
On the basis, yeah.
Yeah.
Bruce?
Thanks very much. I'm also very supportive of the staff's recommendation in terms of what's been there. I mean, it makes complete sense to me. I guess just one thing I wanted to highlight was the discussion I'd had where my concern had been that people would have tried to potentially start using this on things like non-insurance financial assets and that. And from my discussion with the staff, they'd said the intention was to just limit this to those C29 assets. So I was just going to highlight, say, when we do the wording, just to make sure that people can't start pushing the boundaries a bit and applying this to things we didn't intend. But yeah, I'm supportive.
I also support staff's recommendation. I think the reason is very simple, because since the classification overlay will be available for those companies applying IFRS 9 and IFRS 17 on January 1st, 2023, why those entities already applied IFRS 9 could not be use this classification overlay approach, because I think our suggestion, narrow scope amendment should encourage those early adopters of IFRS 9 rather than discourage, those early adopters of IFRS 9. So that means those companies have already, applied IFRS 9 should be treated equally fairly compared to those later adopted of IFRS 9. So with that reason, I fully support staff's recommendation.
Thank you. Bertrand, Mary, you're fine. You're covered.
So Jinshao asset.
Okay, excellent.
Who said mine?
So I don't see any other board members wishing to speak. Are we then ready to vote on question two? Do we agree with the staff recommendation to expand the scope?
12.
Excellent. Good track record here, Laura. So that sets the bar for Lyra.
Okay. Well, now that we've discussed the scope, moving on to 2B, which provides the feedback and staff analysis and recommendations on two other matters relating to classification overlay. Those are firstly impairment requirements and secondly disclosures. And I intend to introduce each matter separately. So starting on impairment, so respondents here fully agreed with the proposal, but identified some areas where they said they will benefit from clarifications, and we describe these areas in paragraph 7 of the paper. The staff analysis for these areas is set out in paragraphs 9 to 14 of the paper. And on the basis of that analysis, we're not recommending the board to change the proposal in the exposure draft, but we intend to consider some drafting improvements when preparing the final amendment to enhance the clarity on the areas where respondents have asked for clarifications. So with that, I'll hand over to the board to discuss and vote on question one of the 2B paper.
Have any comments? Mm-hmm. Leo, please.
Thank you, Andreas. And thank you, Lira, for the staff paper. That's a good one that helps to understand some practical questions. I think that the questions raised by or the clarification asked by the respondents on paragraph 7, I really like them. I would have the same. I think they are very good. And then I agree that we should try to work when drafting the final amendment to try to address it in the standard or the basis for conclusion, whatever makes more sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just impairment, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah. I just want to say I support staff's recommendation, because previously the wording of paragraph 328 only said that an entity is not required to apply the impairment requirement in section 5.5 of IFRS 9. And there is a question, not required, but how about previously those companies apply IFRS 39, whether they needed to apply those impairment requirements, or if those companies apply classic overlay approach, whether they need to, you know, apply, because there are some classification changes, they need to come back to apply impairment requirements of IFRS 39 or need to apply IFRS 9. So I feel those classification currently staff recommended are really helpful for those companies to make sure what's the meaning is not required to apply the impairment requirements of IFRS 9. And I think those classifications are really helpful. Thank you.
Two-part question. So the second part of which is impairment, but there's kind of a precursor that supports that. When I was thinking about the questions we got, it struck me that I think we should have a very clear statement that if as a result of applying the overlay an asset is moved from an IAS 39 category to an IFRS 9 category for purposes of the comparative period, that you're applying not just the classification but also the measurement relevant to that classification for the gross amount of the asset. And I think if you know what you're looking for in the wording in the ED, you see that it says apply the classification and measurement requirements. But I think it's worth, you know, just putting a few blinking lights around that to say that by saying and measurement, we are referring to the, you know, the pre-impairment, you know, kind of gross measurement. Then when I get to the impairment piece, which is that was kind of the predicate, I had to go back and think about that when I thought about the impairment because of the permission but not the requirement to do IFRS 9 impairments. So take my poor little asset that I moved from one category under IAS 39 to a category that has a different measurement basis under IFRS 9. And so you have done the remeasurement. I think if you're allowed to do the associated IFRS 9 impairment for that item, but you're not required to. If you're not required to, then I assume that you must just carry over whatever the IAS 39 impairment is rather than trying to reapply the IAS 39 impairment for whatever classification is closest to the one you've done. But it isn't explicit, and I think especially given that we have permission, I think we need to say that requirement to apply the classification and measurement of IFRS 9, how that interacts with the permission but not the requirement to apply IFRS 9. And I think it's something we have to say in the standard, not at great length, but just make it clear what kind of the different applicability of those pieces are. And then I'll come back when we start talking about disclosures to, you know, whether there's any consequences for information needs of having what could be a few odd circumstances. When you think about a potential for mismatch between the overlay classification under IFRS 9 and the impairment that had been measured under IAS 39. But I'm relying. You were nodding your head, so you agree with me, right, about your choices are A or B. It's either IFRS 9 or IAS 39. It's not redoing a new IAS 39.
No, it is keeping what you had before if it still applies to that measurement category.
What, we're speaking in tongues. I'm not sure I even know what you guys are discussing, but anyway. just a few observations and expectations. So thinking about the impairment sent me down the same sort of rabbit warren that Mary went down in terms of what do we actually anticipate in terms of the gross carrying amount. So I just want to make sure that what I've been thinking is what you guys are thinking. So
let's assume we've got a situation, and I think we think this is the minority of cases, but not impossible. I have something. Lyra looks nervous. She's worried what's going to come out of my mouth. So I've got a situation where I've got something measured at fair value under 39, and it's going to be measured at amortised cost under 9. So I'm not the direction we expect people to be going in terms of when they want to do this, but possible. So if I understand correctly, basically what people need to do is they need to look to apply the overlay. They need to look at the transition requirements in IFRS 9, which say that if I'm moving fair value through P&L, say to amortised cost, in an ideal world, subject to hindsight, you go back and you apply amortised cost retrospectively and you come up with your gross carrying amount. But if you can't do that, it's not impracticable, whatever the words are, then you use the old fair value as your anchor for your starting measurement for the amortised cost measurement in 9. And that's what we're expecting people to do.
Yes.
Essentially look at the, as if they were applying the transition requirements, because they're sort of shooting for what they think the effect would be if they had applied 9. And so that's what we intend, yeah?
And I think that's why in the exposure draft we said you do the classification and measurement, and we deliberately included the words measurement in there to sort of address Mary's point about it's not just moving assets from out of a amortized cost into a fair value category without remeasuring them to fair value, because if you did that, you wouldn't have solved the mismatch that you wanted to solve. So, but along with that, we said it is consistent with the way that you think 9 is going to apply. So it means not just the classification, but it's also the transition requirements, like you say, about what is the gross carry.
Amortized cost to fair value, you actually need to go to fair value.
Yep.
That's sort of the easier one to think about. And then in terms of expectations, again, in terms of impairment. So the reason why we're being careful, I think, with, certainly the reason why I'm hoping we're being careful with the wording on impairment, is because this is an amendment to 17. It's not an amendment to 9. And there's already requirements in 9, and people have worked out what they think those words mean, blah, blah, blah. So we don't want to upset readings of 9 and application of 9 at this 11th hour, if you like, of people coming into the IFRS 17. But I think our expectation is that people would either be applying the 9 impairment or the 39 impairment, not some wacky impairment model they've made up themselves. Yeah, so it's sort of either one or the other.
Yeah,
and I think that's why we were being specific to say, in response to that question, are we required to now update and think about again what would have been IAS 39 impairment? We were not intending for that to be the case.
Bruce?
Thanks very much. I mean, I'm broadly supportive of it, and I mean, I'm the first to accept that practically we need to get this out the door. So, I mean, it could be dangerous to start trying to go down the route of providing too much guidance on every nuance that's available on those. I guess the two things I was just concerned about when I look at the issues in paragraph 7, I mean, 7A I'm happy with, and it's C28C covers. But when we start getting into those other two, I think from what I'm right, the intention is to maybe address it a bit more through the basis than through the standard. I think we've just got to... Maybe it's just a comment that when we start getting to where we just got to make sure it's clear to people what they have to do and what the options are for them to do. And I guess my concern comes in more not that we're dealing with the very large insurance companies who are way ahead on their 17 and 9 implementations and who are there, is you kind of get to some of those smaller insurance companies that maybe are starting to grapple with some of these things, starting to look at what they're going to do. And my worry is when we start putting things like this even into a basis, they could read this and go, oh, that's a very good point. I hadn't thought about that. And we're going to start creating potential stumbling blocks for them that they hadn't actually considered. So I think just a caution to make sure that we make sure they understand exactly what the wording is saying and what the options are to them. I mean, I'm not saying we must put requirements in the basis, because I don't think that would be our intention, but I just do get concerned that we're kind of highlighting issues to people that they may not have thought about, and if they don't feel the standard addresses it, then the next thing is urgent appeals to the interpretations, and they don't understand, and the next thing we're trying to deal with this is another urgent amendment to something we've already put out as a pretty timely amendment as well.
Okay. I think those
that have spoken are generally supportive, so obviously the proof pudding is then do we get the wording right? The intention, I think, is understood and is shared. Can I see a show of hands who agrees with the staff recommendation?
12. Good. Okay. So moving on to the second matter in the 2B paper, disclosures. There were two suggestions relating to disclosures. Firstly, some respondents who asked for additional disclosure, mainly quantitative information about the effects of the classification overlay. And the second issue or suggestion on disclosure was coming from other respondents, suggesting that the board changes the timing on which it requires disclosures about initial application of IFRS 9. So that would be requiring those disclosures at the date the entity first applies the classification overlay instead of as at the date of initial application of IFRS 9 as it is currently required by IFRS 7. So on the first issue about additional disclosures of the effects of the overlay, we focused our analysis on whether quantitative disclosures about those effects would be justified from a cost-benefit perspective. And in doing so, we thought about, firstly, the reason that respondents are asking for additional disclosures about the effects of the overlay is because the classification overlay is a transition option, and in their view, this reduces comparability amongst insurers. But as we explain in the paper, the fact is that without the classification overlay, there will already be a lack of comparability between comparative information presented by different insurers on initial application of IFRS 9, and that is because of the transition reliefs and the options provided by the standard. And in those circumstances, entities are not required to provide specific disclosures about comparative. With the classification overlay, on the other hand, the comparative information would only be more consistent with IFRS 9 and not less consistent. And so from that perspective, it could be regarded as counterintuitive to add comprehensive disclosures about the entities that are choosing to apply the classification overlay. And I think on the last point about sort of cost, we were also conscious that requiring quantitative disclosures could risk negating the operational benefits that are being provided through the classification overlay. On the benefit side, we note that there is limited relevance to users of financial statements of the information about the classification overlay because the classification overlay only relates to presentation of comparative information, and that only in the reporting period that the insurer is applying IFRS 9 and IFRS 17. And also, the classification overlay is only depicting an accounting phenomenon, not an economic phenomenon. And I think for all these reasons, we are not recommending additional disclosures, particularly quantitative information about the effects of the overlay. On the second disclosure issue about changing the timing, we are not recommending that the board changes the timing on which it requires entities to provide disclosures about initial application of IFRS 9, primarily because in our view, disclosures about the classification overlay, even if they were to be required, cannot replace disclosures about initial application of IFRS 9. For the reasons that we laid out in the paper. So with that, I'll hand over to the board to discuss and vote on question two of the paper.
I agree with your recommendations in terms of particularly the timing of those transition disclosures, because you know, it's possible for an entity to decide to apply the overlay only to very few assets in theory, and so we'd have a real completeness issue if that were the substitute for the full transition disclosures. In terms of disclosures then more generally, my only suggestion in addition to what you've discussed in here is, given that we do have this situation where there could be different things going on with impairment, I think it might be important that there's disclosure to help investors understand, you know, what choices have been made in terms of how the impairment models have been applied, so that people understand what it is that they're looking at. You know, you've got this total impairment number, but what's behind it? Is it ECL? Is it incurred loss? Is it a combination of it? You know, just a disclosure about that I think would be helpful for transparency.
Bruce?
to make the same point as Sue, just in terms of the what people have done. So it's not much about putting the numbers in, but I just think we do need to understand what people have done. So, yeah.
Beginning to feel it's upside down world. I actually agree with the staff's recommendation on not adding the disclosures. So put a pin in that.
And red marker to the
differential. Yeah, sure. We take notes. The reason I come to that conclusion, and there are four big points, is one is we are starting from an accounting mismatch. Is we've identified a group of assets that are stranded, and we're going to continue to have an accounting mismatch. So what the overlay is going to do is get us from three disparate groups down to two disparate groups, but increase comparability within one of those two groups by making the stranded assets more comparable over time. And I think the two bigger things that weigh on me is that this is comparative period information, and I think that means there's far less incentive to do anything malicious or take any actions, because if you think about the balance sheet, people do look at that over time and look at the ratios, but as far as a prior income statement, I think users tend to put far less emphasis on that. I would go so far as to say most actually ignore it, particularly if it's restated. Other than to create the trend, which I think we're probably creating a little bit better trend here overall. And then the last reason I say that is we're looking at derecognized assets here. So if you're thinking about this issue of what are your incentives, we already have the final answer. We know what the answer is. We know what they left the balance sheet at in terms of value. So I think that also reduces a lot of the issues. So I'm just not sure as a user how I would take the information on this accounting mismatch and then apply it. So in this case, I think there's cost but not a lot of real benefit, because I don't think people will go out and actually use the information, whereas for a lot of transition disclosures, I think they're key and vital. But in this narrow issue, I'm not sure that's the case.
Mary?
I'll start with the easier bit, which is the second part of your question, and I agree, with the staff analysis and recommendation about not making any change in the date at which the transition disclosures apply, or giving any flex on that one. It should be everybody all at the same date. Going back to the harder to discuss, I guess been able to think about the different categories of items to which the overlay would apply. The group that Zach focused on, those items for which you're looking to apply the overlay because they were derecognized in the comparative period, his analysis gives me a lot of comfort about, okay, if is it really worth going back and trying to force somebody to tune something between the impairment line and the gain or loss line? And the answer being no, especially for a comparative period. So good with that. But if I think about the remaining population to which the overlay may be applied, which is the an entity that has elected not to restate the comparatives, but does elect to apply the overlay, I guess I want to stop, and I stopped to think about whether or not there could be a change in the impairment. I'm trying really hard not to call it an allowance, and I just can't think of a different word. A change in the amount of impairment recognized. And I think there could be, for example, if in effect you move something to fair value P&L, and therefore it had, it was not measured at fair value before, to the extent it had an impairment allowance, it would now be measured at fair value P&L, and so in effect you'd be applying the IFRS 9 impairment, which would be zero because it's fair value P&L. So there's the potential for there being a change in the amount of the impairment recognized in the comparative period. And without getting into lots of quantitative requirements for that, question one is, have you thought about whether any kind of discussion about the change in impairment would be useful to users, and B, whether it would be required. And then I come back to the type of information Sue was asking for about, you know, tell us what you did. You know, just give, there's all these moving parts. Just give us a qualitative discussion about, you know, how you approach this. Do we have specific requirements that would require somebody to provide both that generic and that discussion of impairment? And if not, don't we have to insert them into the disclosure requirements at this time?
So I think the easy bit, disclosing impairment, so how you've applied, whether you've applied I+9 impairment or not. We think it's a natural extension of probably, because we already have a disclosing the fact that you have applied the overlay. So this would be sort of an addition of what impairment have you applied to those assets. I think the second one you're alluding to.
Lira, on that, so maybe we should look at, you know, if we say you disclose whether you applied the overlay, maybe it's including what approach you took.
Yeah, so that's what I mean when I say we could extend it. The second one is, I think it's more about looking at the comparatives and if there's any significant change, are there any existing disclosures that could ask the entity to explain. I think that's how I understand your comment. And
if not, do we have to add something?
Mm. And I think we've been thinking about and sort of going back to some of the disclosures more generally in IS-1 or IS-8, and I think that's sort of the disclosures we are thinking about that could capture that. But
I guess, yes, they are general disclosures in IFRS-7 and IS-1 telling you that you need to provide supplementary information about changes in your financial statements and, you know, between periods if the changes are significant and it's not captured by other disclosures. So I think a combination of those general disclosure requirements, and we can remind people of those, plus the transition disclosures that you in any case have to do on the date of initial application to explain the changes between the two. I think, you know, if you take all of that in combination, you would get, and if we then maybe add the qualitative statement about which impairment allowance you have or model you've applied, then that should get the information there.
But then I think it's worth spelling out, you know, why we think it's not necessary to write explicit disclosure requirements for these things, because bringing together those different strands and realizing what their implication is and what the threshold is, you know, you just, and I'm not going to hold you to this because you're doing it off the top of your head, you just said if there are any significant changes, you have, you know, explain them, just making sure we pick up the right triggers.
But I would encourage that to make it really explicit, and partially for the reason that Bruce was pointing out the previous question. You don't have to think only about the big companies, but also to smaller insurance companies that are actually doing this. And can we rest assured that they actually have the general disclosure requirements in mind, right? So I think just a reminder, when doing this, also think about the general disclosures of IFRS 7 and IFRS 1. I think this wouldn't hurt, really. Yeah. Okay. Rika?
Thank you. After listening to staff's comment about Mary's point, I think I agree I support the staff's recommendation not to include additional specific requirement of disclosure, because I think the overlay approach itself is incremental to the existing requirement of IFRS 9's transition and initial application. So management's choice to apply this approach, classification overlay approach, that means that represents probably the enhancing the comparative information over the period, especially for assessing the future performance of the insurance businesses. That means if the investor really want to see the comparability in the past, they can check that information in the previous year's financial statement and understand how that happened. And then, so I think, I understand the benefit of the additional information, but still, if we just want to focus on the objective of this project, I would support staff's recommendation.
I agree with the staff recommendation. Two comments, maybe. Like Sue and Bruce, I think we can add factual specific requirements stating which impairment requirements have been applied. And yes, I can be in favor of adding disclosure requirements. and second thing, I have sympathy for the preparers that have asked potentially to change the first time application date for the disclosure requirements, but I perfectly appreciated the reason, your explanations, and the reason why we cannot allow that. So I'm fine with your recommendation.
Thank you. Tadeo?
Thank you, Andreas. I agree with the staff recommendation to finalize the amendment without amending disclosures about the initial application of IFRS 9, even for impairment. After some discussion with the staff, what I understood is that in the end of the day, it just affects the comparative. It doesn't have any impact in the current year, the year of the application, actually. One of the arguments that used here, that just having costs for preparers and without little benefit to users. The transition options that we already have for the application of IFRS 17 in conjunction with IFRS 9 would not actually make companies very comparative, because you have all these options now. We are already in an environment that is not very comparative. I really don't think that is adding more disclosure would be helpful. And in terms of the paragraph 24A, when we say that the term of time limited, it only provides transitional relief for entities that will first apply IFRS 9 and IFRS 17. Actually, is a relief for those applying IFRS 17, and that is an interaction with IFRS 9, because I can have some insurers that have already applied IFRS 9, and some that have not applied IFRS 9. What makes them in the same situation is that both are applying IFRS 17. And then what we are discussing here is IFRS 17 disclosures and relief. That's why I fully agree with the staff's recommendation for not adding more disclosures. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadeo.
Nick?
Thank you. So continuing our exercise in role reversal, I also support the staff recommendation. And I won't be as eloquent as Zach was in terms of expressing the reasons. There's going to be a huge amount going on with the first time application of IFRS 17. And I think what we're talking about in terms of additional disclosures will be at the margin. They're potentially noise. They may even be distracting. So I would absolutely stick with where we are.
Sure.
I just want to double check something with you guys. I think I know the answer, but it's important, and I'm sorry, I only thought of it now. I would have asked you before. So in IFRS 7, we've got these disclosure requirements on the initial application of IFRS 9, and they're all designed to give a snapshot picture of, okay, you were here under 39, you've come to here under 9. It's a mapping. You know, these were your 39 categories, these are your 9 categories, so this is where, you know, this is what we did. And even though an entity now may have come along and actually applied 9 pretty much to everything, let's say, in the comparative period, we're still intending that they show a snapshot that's the movement from the 39 numbers to the 9 numbers as at the date of initial application of 9, despite the application of the overlay and the restatement of comparatives, actually, for that matter. Yeah? Yeah. So the fact that they've actually got nine numbers in the comparatives and then they go into nine numbers doesn't detract from the fact they still have to apply the 39 to 9 analysis as at the date of initial application of 9. Yeah?
That's right. And I think that was, you know, 9 is that way even for people outside of 17, that if you restate comparatives, you still give that disclosure on the date of initial application based on, you know, the difference at that date. 39 to 9, and that was to get everybody on the same page, given the choice of restatement. So, yes, that's the point.
And just because I think Nick and Zach are sort of relaxed-ish, because we're mainly talking about comparatives, and so it's helping because it's a smoother ride into 9 and 17. But I think even though the overlay that we're talking about is sort of on the margins totally in the context of 17 and 9, I just want to make sure we don't lose sight of the fact that actually there's a massive transition change for these insurers as well, which is the initial application of 9. And I'd hate, just because of this, that suddenly everybody forgets that transition disclosure is really key to understanding the move into 9 itself.
And yeah, and it's part of, sorry, Leroy, it's because of that we are not recommending changing it if you apply the classification overlay, or, you know, that 9 even didn't say if you restate comparative, you give it at that date. It kept it at that date for everybody, so everyone is on the same, yep, in the same boat at the same date.
Might be worth just noting in the basis that in addition not tinkering with 9 for the requirements in there, we also not tinkering with the disclosure requirements in 7.
Yeah.
Just so people don't miss that.
Yeah, I think the second part of the disclosure issue was that I think the request was to sort of amend 7 so that, yeah, you apply, and we were really intending not to do that because we wanted for everyone to have that clarity that at the date of initial application of 9, everyone does the disclosures, and that's when the users will get the most comparability.
So on that basis, can we vote? Can I see who's in favour of the staff recommendation?
Just before we do the vote, maybe there was a couple of board members that made suggestions on, or a suggestion to add the qualitative statement. So along with saying whether you've applied the overlay approach, to say what impairment requirements you have applied. So maybe we could slightly tweak the question to include that that change. Just so that you vote,
disclosing the fact of what impairment has been applied to the assets that the overlay is applied to.
Yeah. Okay. Everybody clear about that? Okay. Can we vote? See who's in favour.
12.
Well done. Excellent. So we get to PIPA 2C. Laura?
So the final paper summarises the due process steps that have been taken and asks the board two questions. Question one asks for permission to begin the balloting process to finalise the amendment. And then question two asks if any board member intends to dissent from the final amendment. And if the board agrees today to start the balloting process, we expect to finalise the amendment to be issued in December, along with the board's initial expectation of when this would be finalised. So I will now hand over to you to discuss 2C.
Okay. Any comments, questions? Can we go straight to voting? Seems so. All right.
Sorry, Tadeo would like to.
Tadeo, please.
Yes, thank you, Andreas. It's just to reinforce something that I said for the paper A, and it's clear in paper B when we say in paragraph 18, we did not receive any comment letters from users of financial statements, despite we have a very clever, intelligent, smart users in our boat. I'm just wondering whether for the completeness of the process, whether we could do something just to be sure that users' voice are heard.
No one get it out.
I wonder whether that is really part of the due process question. It's probably giving us more comfort, but I would hate. I mean, it is important. Don't get me wrong, but I would hate
are seeing being held back in concluding on this project because we believe that we haven't heard an explicit agreement with that user group. So, I mean, if we can do that on a smart basis without actually holding back finalization of this amendment, be my guess. But I wouldn't say it's contingent on us actually getting back to the user groups. That would be my view. And I would really park that with the staff and see whether you can feed that in somehow. Okay? So on that basis, could we vote on question one? Are we satisfied that all due process steps have been complied with and have been concluded?
12.
And is there any board member that intends to dissent?
Maybe I can just precise that I had just arrived when the ED was issued, so I abstained. I think this time, if I'm allowed to, I won't abstain. Well, I mean, I won't dissent either.
Yeah, that's the more important thing, you know. As long as you consent, you are allowed to vote. Okay, excellent. Thank you, ladies. So I would suggest that we actually break now for 15 minutes and come back. I'll be gracious to you. 11:15.